after that, the retrospective after an incident is an opportunity to really learn a ton about our systems, and we don't take the time to do it. And that was the perfect opportunity to do it. And sometimes there is given, so I'm not saying it happens all the time, but there are times where a team is given that space to go do that. And that's what I'm really calling for here, is like, what's missing is this time to be able to go do it, because it is normal, real work for folks to go do. Another thing we tend to do is only have one meeting, which is a combination of the retrospective and remediation items.
And all it's 50 minutes long.
It's 50 minutes long, exactly.
It's shorter than the incident was.
Right, exactly.
Welcome to the Better Incidents Podcast, where we hear from reliability-obsessed responders who are at the forefront of the movement to better manage, remediate, and learn from incidents. I'm your host, Robert Ross. After the dust of an incident settles, it's normal for us to want to move on and get back to less stressful work. But doing so would skip an essential part of the incident management process, the retro. Today, I'm talking to Chad Todd, Site Reliability Manager at CrowdStrike, about the importance of retros and to avoid what he calls incident amnesia. Chad, welcome to the Better Incidents Podcast. It's really great to have you here. We've met a couple of times. I think you have a lot of great insights around incidents and all things in between them, retrospectives, which is going to be a hot topic for us today. But before we dive into that, it'd be great to learn a little bit about you. Where have you been? Where have you gone? What have you learned? And what got you to where you are today at CrowdStrike?
Yeah, I actually graduated from college in 2001. And then I took a job at a healthcare IT company and worked there for 19 and a half years, which is probably insane to folks hearing that. It's almost 20 years of my lifetime of working there. And then I basically came up through the ranks there and actually kicked off their site reliability engineering organization around 2016. It's thriving today. It's a much larger organization than it was then. And then I kicked over to another company in more of the construction industry environment, and they were producing a SaaS-based project management software. Worked there for a little bit, and then mainly did incident management, incident response, incident analysis. So very much in the vein of performing retrospectives and things like that. And then from there, I worked for another company for about a year in the customer relationship management group, or area, I would say, environment, industry, competitor to Salesforce. And so from there, worked there for about a year, being more in the engineering management side of that space as a senior manager, and essentially working on their status, their homegrown status page, and their incident management, incident response platform that they actually had homegrown in-house. Tried to get incident analysis off the ground. I think that was that journey was going to be taken after I had left there. And so this kind of came about, opportunity at CrowdStrike to be a manager over a brand new, I'm kind of used to kicking off groups around creating site reliability engineering organizations and teams and whatnot. So got hired here working for a tech ops production systems group as a manager for SRE. And we are, funny enough, revamping our incident management and incident response. And that's a main initiative for as soon as I kicked that off, as soon as we got here, given how I had been my third day here, I was, seeing some things that I needed to work on. So that was kind of where I landed. So it's been a 20 plus year journey. It was 23 or 4 years now. So yeah, it's been great. I would say probably my biggest accomplishment as of recently was in 2022. I graduated from Leon University in Human Factors and System Safety, where a lot of the incident analysis stuff, a lot of that comes from cognitive task analysis and things like that. And my thesis was handover communications and software operations, which we don't talk about enough. So yeah, that's a whole other topic that's awesome. We could get into. Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. And congrats on going through that and coming out. There's a lot of great folks that have gone through that program. I know that are now, you know, using that experience for software.
Yes.
So you walked in, it's your first day, And on day three, they said, congrats, we now have an incident management program. Did you know that was going to happen?
No, it was really me kind of assessing the landscape quite quickly after the quick onboarding. And I had, you know, there was, not to get too deep, there was an event going on, and I jumped in on it just to listen and see how it was going within the group. And kind of noticed some things where some prior experiences were like, this isn't where we need to be as a company and an organization and a department, really. And so I pitched that to my director about creating an initiative around incident management and incident response within my first week here, and it was a go. And so that is what we're about 3+ months in, and we're working on that and hopefully be able to land it globally here around July timeframe. So yeah, it's been great.
That's quite a turnaround.
Yes.
That's a lot of clout.
Very
to
much.
Come in and first week, like, I want to introduce a program. You know, I was still looking for the bathroom, I think, on my fourth day of every job I've had. So you are a get shit done kind of person, I think. So
pretty much.
I mean, so it sounds like, you know, you have opinions on the management process, and it sounds like you came in and you were kind of observing maybe the retrospective mm-hmm. aspect of it. And it sounds like that was, you know, your ears were perking up, and you know the flags were some color, maybe yellow, maybe red in some cases. And what were the challenges that they were facing that to run a good retro? What was missing that on day four you said, I want to introduce a program for this?
Yeah, some of the top challenges that I had saw from the retro side is some of the power dynamics that it entailed. So it can be a bit tricky at times. Leaders tend to want to be in those meetings to get some information mm-hmm. or get some knowledge, but then it also can create an area where the floor on the floor gets yielded to the leaders because they're the highest paid people in the room. And so it's like, oh, they're going to, you know, they kind of like other folks that are, you know, senior engineers or just your software engineers or developers, they may, you know, let them yield to the floor, and then all of a sudden it's like they're dictating the narrative of the retro. Yeah. And it does get to that sense where, you know, you want to have an area where that somewhat kind of goes into my next thing, is keeping the environment safe and open and allowing other people to speak up about the events and retros. And that was some of the pieces of this as well. So that's a couple challenges. A third challenge is like keeping people focused on the retrospectives and what people can learn from it versus just going straight to wanting to chat about remediation items. So that tends to be a thing that, every company I've been at, that seems to be a thing where we tend to want to like, what can we action on and what can we action on? You know, I've talked about the term before in some other environments of like this whole thing around action item factories, where the focus becomes, that's what you want to do. And we can become this factory of just action items. And really, there's a tendency to want to go do that, which is a big challenge. And in fact, it can hinder the need to learn and gain insights about the incident, which is much more important, because then while you won't potentially have quote unquote repeat incidents, there might be similar ones, you can actually use that knowledge to gain for the next incident management incident response situation that you're in as an engineer and leader, et cetera. Yeah. So, yeah.
I love the concept of like action item factories. I always joked, like I was in a retro many, many years ago, and one of the tickets was like re-architect analytics pipeline. It's like, that's not an action item. That's an action year of work. So, you know, what can we do that's a little bit smaller? But I want to bring it back to something that you said that I think is interesting. You mentioned the power dynamics right off the bat. And, you know, I have the C word in my title, and the challenge is that, you know, coming from a technical background, I want to see it, right?
Yeah.
So what would you tell me now if you saw me join the channel mm-hmm. and you have this new program you're putting in place and you see me join the retro, how would you politely tell me go away?
Yeah, so I think I would actually probably may just do it if there was a chat. I've seen this done before, is a asynchronous conversation of saying, hey, do you mind dropping from the call? And so we can have more of an open conversation. There might be some thing. There might be areas where folks don't feel like they can speak up because you're in here and you were looking to get actions and engineer and look at those things to basically focus on. And I would politely do it more asynchronously versus trying to do it up front and in the speak. And I would even try to do it even pre potentially if I knew that you were being invited. But if you just popped in, I would essentially just have the conversation and say, and really I open up facilitation of like, this is an open conversation. This is a very safe environment. Keep it at that level and let's focus on what we can learn from it and kind of put this ground rules in place. And if you were to join, I would politely really say, hey, you know, Robert, do you mind dropping from the call? I will be the facilitator. I'll give you an update of what was discussed and all the information about it and kind of give you a synopsis of what all the things that went on within the retrospective, because we will have like a scribe in the room to actually pull you aside and have an update. And here's the things that and if you had more questions, I could bring that back to the group as well in more of an ad hoc way. So it's just a polite, hey, you know, do you mind dropping from the call as we facilitate this? And we'll give you an update right afterwards about what was all said, because we will have a scribe in the room to really talk about that and take notes and whatnot. So that's how I would really handle it. And I think that would be, I think that's professional.
Yeah, no, and I think that's, you know, I would not be offended if that was said to me, right?
And yeah.
So it's all, most of the time it's well-intentioned.
It is.
But you are right, that power dynamic can shift very quickly. And someone may not want to admit that they maybe made a mistake. The mistake is not, you know, they're not, no one's blaming them for that thing. But, you know, maybe they don't want to say, I mistyped something and I dropped a database. You know, that may not want to be said in front of the CTO.
Yes, exactly. So, and that tends to happen. Yeah.
Yeah. So what is missing from this process, right? I think that there's a few things, especially in a remote culture, that retrospectives, you know, we may want to think about, like, what are we missing from this process here?
Yeah. And I could talk to this a little bit too. Time and meeting culture. It's really, I would say, as an industry, we tend to want to move fast and as quickly as possible, trying to get the retrospective over with and move on. I tend to say companies, especially with the industries I've been in and dealt with, we tend to have incident amnesia. It's like we gotta get this done and move on. And so after the retrospective after an incident is an opportunity to really learn a ton about our systems, and we don't take the time to do it. And that was the perfect opportunity to do it. And sometimes there is given. So I'm not saying that happens all the time, but there are times where a team is given that space to go do that. And that's what I'm really calling for here is like, what's missing is this time to be able to go do it, because it is normal, real work for folks to go do. Another thing we tend to do is only have one meeting, which is a combination of the retrospective and remediation items.
And it's 50 minutes long.
It's 50 minutes long, exactly.
It's shorter than the incident was.
Right, exactly. And so a recommendation to that, what's missing, is to have this retrospective then 24 hours, then have it, and then 24 hours have this reflection time, or they call it soak time, which really comes from Todd Conklin, who's an expert on human performance. And so then you have the remediation items separate from that, essentially separating those meetings out. So I think we tend to have this. So when you have that one meeting, like you said, 50 minutes, you're trying to talk about it really quick, and then we got to get to the action items. I've been in places where that's the case as a facilitator, and then like the last 5 minutes is like you're wrapping out these action items, and who knows if they're good or not. So it's this idea to reflect on the conversation and then have a second meeting. And I know that's tough. And then also the value of retrospectives. So getting retrospectives viewed as valuable and real work by leaders, especially when the incident analysis or facilitators are prepping for the retrospective, is misreviewed as low stakes work, when in fact it is high stakes work for the organization to learn from their incidents versus like rubber stamping them out, which is essentially leads to write, fix, and file, essentially, you know. And we've heard that before in the industry, but it still happens. I mean, I've talking to folks at some of the conferences I've been to already this year, from SREcon to LFIconf, that seems to still be almost a recommended practice, which it's not. You need to give that space. And so those areas, I feel, are things that what is actually missing from retrospectives. And a lot of them can be given, I think, from a leadership side, too, to have that buy-in to be able to do that type of work. So, yeah, that's my take on that.
Yeah, I think that aligns pretty well with my view of the world, too. It's where it's, you know, you should feel like you can have more meetings, but we do have to. But then the business person in me also says, you know, if this is a Sev1 and there's, say, you know, 15 engineers in this call for an hour, that's a pretty expensive meeting, right?
I agree.
If someone that just thinks in numbers. So how would you maybe equate a retro? And I'm not saying, you know, figure out an equation on the spot here, but how do you emphasize the ROI of this? It's not just a meeting that costs us this amount of money. It's a meeting that is going to save us money in the future.
Yeah. So you're actually trying to quantify the return on our investment, but there's also probably a qualitative side to that as well. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the challenges, right, that we tend to deal with. And I think you have to kind of show from that, like, the markers of progress to spend this type of time on there. So are you getting more people to decide to attend those post-incident review meetings, as an example? Are you using, like, can you point to things like, we're using our incident documentation that we've put into a incident library to then help our people, new people on board, and whether they're seasoned or non-seasoned, then you can use some of that documentation information to actually help them get up to speed and coming up to speed on the systems that they're actually going to be using, and use those incident retro documentation libraries to actually get them up to speed for things. And it's a very powerful thing to do, because then they might actually have more questions, or like, what happened here? And you're actually creating an evolution, a revolution for folks to use their incident documentation as part of their onboarding, which is, I've seen work really awesome from that perspective.
I love that. I love that so much. I mean, it's not just about figuring out how to improve the system and learn from it. And, you know, maybe it takes 5 incident retrospectives before you really know what that, call it an action item, really needs to be, right?
Right.
But I love the concept of using retrospectives as onboarding material. I think that's really smart. So I'd love to change gears a little bit here and ask, how do retros kind of impact the work your teams do after an incident, right? Like, how does it feed into the roadmap?
This is a great topic. So I have some views from this, but what I found over 20 plus years experience is that the immediate things get fixed quite quickly. They might even get fixed, and I've been in post-incident reviews before, or retrospectives, as we're calling them, you know, get fixed before the retrospective actually even occurs. And then they usually are this low-hanging fruit. There's like, oh, this code, you know, was a configuration piece, and it got, you know, it had the wrong value. So they go and they fix it even during the incident, and repush the, you know, push the code out, and then it fixes the problem. But I will say, like, there's this intermediate, long-term remediation items that tend to, the hope is, and I quote that, the hope is that they get put on a roadmap. And I say that is because, depending on the organization's needs and how they view reliability, sometimes those remediation items are just on the roadmap, but then never come to light, or they do come to light and tend to call this situation where they just fall to this intermediate long-term area, the Jira abyss. So where these, they fall, they go to die, essentially. So in my experience, the Jira abyss happens more often than not in organizations. And it really comes down to balancing what upper management wants and what they value. So are we valuing both reliability and resilient type intermediate or long-term remediation items as valuable as product features? And that tends to become this whole balance and friction point where teams, I think, tend to get pushed for product features because it's going to make money, and versus essentially protecting the system from a reliability or resilient perspective. So then you have this, it's always those pressures and those trade-offs that, and sacrificing decisions that happen between the two. So it's really what leadership wants to focus on. And yeah, at times leadership I've seen where they're like, we're going to do reliability. It's a corporate main initiative and that's what they're going to focus on. And that's all fine and dandy, but how'd they get there? More than likely they got there because they were pushing product features all the time. And the systems continue to degrade. And so hence why we tend to have this whole idea around the hope of getting these items done, but they never really come to fruition. And I've done many analysis on that to the point in Jira that I show this to leaders and they're like, yep, we'll get it, we'll do it. But then it never gets done. And countless numbers of intermediate to long-term remediations, and they just don't ever make the list. So I think the immediate ones do get done, but then these other ones, they just sit there unless there's some major event that it's like, we need to make things better. And so then they put that on the list to go do the roadmap for a quarter or two quarters as a part of their planning. So that's how I see it happening and how it feeds into the roadmap. It really depends on what is the focus is from the leadership management and even the managers and what they're getting pushed on. So yeah, that's my view on it. Yeah.
I've been thinking about this concept of a sturdy software and you know, what defines sturdy software. And one of the metrics I've kind of played around with in my head is number of outstanding action items. Is that list growing at a rate? You know, what's the burn down of that list really look like? Because I think it's a healthy indicator that you don't really have a culture of improving reliability.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yep.
And so, you know, have you measured that? Are you looking at the depth of that list? Is it just because you're creating a bunch of, you know, big tickets that don't matter? And, you know, like the re-architect pipeline one, right? Like that's just going to be in the abyss for a long time.
It is. And it exactly right. And it just sits there and sits there and sits there and never gets worked on. I completely agree with your assessment on that for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, it's a feature development. Like reliability is a feature. It's,
right.
It is a feature.
It definitely is. It's just how it's viewed at different levels of the organization, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, and we're doing a healthy mix of business and learning from incidents. And there's something that I actually even had a conversation with somebody at SREcon a few weeks ago. I asked, do you have an incident for every retro, no matter what? And, you know, does every incident need a retro? Why or why not? What is your opinion here?
Yeah, so this is a great topic. I think it's probably need to be talked about more, so I'm glad we're actually talking about it here. My view is really no, given how much labor goes into preparing for a retrospective, such as, you know, assembling the timelines, the interviewing participants, if you're going down the analysis path, developing themes, holding those learnings and assembling those reports, there's just a lot of learning and insights from one single incident that to perform that for every single incident will result in exhausted incident analysts and facilitators. To the point, I would say, you get to a point where you experience like reduction of participants, exhaustion for both participants, analysts and facilitators, and then also retrospective write-ups actually will get delayed. It basically becomes this chore versus an opportunity to learn. And I see that also trend towards the whole thing like write, fix, and file. And, you know, that's kind of, I used to, you know, I transitioned one when I was in a company that I was in for almost 20 years. They were doing this whole write, fix, and file, and I had wrote a blog post internally around that particular subject and basically said that we were no longer going to do the write, fix, and file. We were going to actually do less incidents, but do them in a more deeper and broader manner. And that caught a lot of eyes because we took the approach of, you know, we got more out of one single incident than we were doing from just the basic rubber stamping of, yep, we did an incident, we did a retrospective, we're calling it good and moving on, rather than trying to really try to understand our systems in a much deeper and broader manner, both from a technical perspective and from a human performance perspective. So I can attest to that and why you just can't do them all, because then it's just a rubber stamping event. Check the box. We did it. And yep, we gave plus ones to the upper leadership. We got it done for them, et cetera. So yeah, it's that type of thing. So hopefully that's, you know, I'll give your thoughts on that too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. I mean, my in adding on to that, my kind of perspective is that the human behaviors that, you know, eventually mixed into a certain point that ended up in an incident, those behaviors are probably pretty consistent across most incidents, right? If we're shipping code that doesn't get vetted on staging and it caused an incident, that wasn't the first time.
Right.
There's just no way.
Right.
So when we start to get into the technical details of incidents and in incident analysis, like, yeah, those are definitely going to be a little bit more distinct and have a much higher cardinality. But I would say for sure that the human behaviors that cause incidents is you only need to do one really good retro to find a lot of those.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. 100%.
So we're talking about every incident. Does every incident need a retro? We're saying no. But, you know, retros are there to kind of help you improve your incidents over time. So how are you going to get better at doing retros? Are you running retros on the retros? Who's improving the retros at that point?
Yes. The perspective I have, and I actually learned this from some training I got for incident analysis, and one of the recommendations was after you facilitate a group meeting and go through all that and things like that is, you know, the next day, you know, because those facilitations can get, you know, long-winded and you may need to go have a walk or a Coke, so you don't want to do it right after that. Maybe the next day or maybe later this afternoon, you have a retro on your retrospective. And really, that's to consider on ways of getting better at your incident retrospectives that you're facilitating as the, you know, the facilitators that are in the room, the ones that are doing the scribe, those types of folks that are kind of like guiding the whole retrospective for the folks that are involved. And so it's kind of like, how was the audience participation? You know, there are times where as facilitators, we have a lot more information from the incident and gathering everything and all the things we've done to go, you know, get this information. Then we have more information than we want to sometimes speak about the incident as the facilitators and take over the meeting. And as a facilitator, that's really not your position. You're really not to give input. You're there to really guide others, provide and listen to others, provide their insights that you get to actually learn from. And so it can be the sense of like the facilitator gets overly excited to give their input to the point it can be detrimental to the retrospective. So it's something like, is that happening? Those are types of things that, and then other things is like, how are the power dynamics handled? Do we need to do a better, do we need to handle those better? In what ways? Also improving the write-ups as well. Did people read the write-ups? And how well does it tell stories about the incident? Does it contain some rich information and context about the incident of how we kind of got here and into the technical failure and things like that? And also, you also have this sense of like, as you spoke to earlier on, is, you know, was it a situation where somebody deleted the database? And then did the situation get to the point where even if you didn't have a leader in it, other folks believe in the whole human error situation where you blame and shame, it comes into existence, creating a very unsafe environment for folks. So how are you going to deal with that? Which could be a big double whammy, you know, because then folks that weren't involved with the incident, they see this and they're like, oh, I'm never coming to one of these, or I don't want to be part of that. And it creates this, I don't want to be part of an incident retrospective, and it creates retrospectives as a bad name. And so those things you can actually talk about in the retro to get better. Also, why are we lacking participation if that's the case? Or how did people feel like their voice was heard? You know, did we give them a space and a safe space? Did we set the ground rules at the very beginning, or did we miss that? Just overall, the general flow of the incident retrospective would be good too as well. And how's that going? These are just some things to think about and using more of the hows and the whats of what, how do we get better and what can we do to get better? So those are kind of areas I think it's very beneficial to do the incident retrospective to actually gain better footing and then also make your group meetings and facilitations better.
I wonder if I wonder if there's a way to do like sampling on this too, right? Where it's like we're gonna one gets randomly picked and we're gonna show this to someone else, not the team that did it, and you know, and see what they say. And because we often understand the work that we produce very, very well. Is that a printer?
Sorry. Yes.
I love that. Are you being faxed to something?
Hold up.
I just love that you have a printer.
But yes, we have a printer.
I know it'll be edited out. My wife just started printing something while I'm on the podcast.
Oh, that's totally fine. No, it's actually just going to be at the beginning of the podcast now.
Yeah, we'll just put it at the beginning of the podcast.
The last one, someone got paged in the middle of it.
No, it's, yeah, she didn't know, but that's okay.
It's okay. We'll run a retro on it later.
Yeah, but we'll have to see what's going on there.
What I was saying is, I forget what I was saying. I think that, you know, picking random people around the organization to review a retro, I think, is a fair maneuver.
Oh, yeah.
And I've also seen organizations, I've seen recommendations of this, like, you know, pick someone random to run the retro. Someone that wasn't there. I've even seen, like, someone that isn't technical, because they're going to ask questions that are so high level. They're not going to ask about, you know, like, what was the database doing at time X? Maybe they do, maybe they don't, but I think it just changes the dynamic a lot, and it forces people to kind of do like and explain it like I'm not an engineer.
Yeah, and the other, yes, exactly, and I think that's a great idea too. I've also seen from that side too, like the facilitators of the group folks will send out a survey to understand, like, to try to figure out qualitatively how people felt about the retro. And kind of capture and basically capture that data to then talk about it in their incident retrospective to better understand their audience and areas that can improve as well. So doing a survey, if you can get folks to fill it out, I know we probably get inundated with surveys as, and you know, associates, employees at companies. But yeah, it's kind of beneficial to actually try to get some type of qualitative data from a survey perspective to understand areas for the facilitation and group meetings and things like that to take place. I've heard we're taking too much time on action items before too, as well, from some of those surveys. So it's interesting to hear that as well, from that perspective. But yeah, those are both great ideas, I think, for sure, for folks.
Awesome. So wrapping up here, we've talked a lot about you're implementing a process today. You studied this. You've experienced it. Where do you think the industry is today on this, you know, analyzing incidents journey? And where do you think we'll be in 3 years, 5 years? Because it feels like we're at the beginning of it still, in many ways. And, you know, just take us home here. What's next for this practice?
Yeah, this is a great topic. We talked about it a lot in various groups and communities, and I think you're definitely right. We're at the very beginning. I mean, if you kind of look at some of the companies that have come about, that started kind of the incident analysis piece, you know, we're about 5 years in from that when that kind of started. But I think there's we're probably got another, unfortunately, like fortunately, you know, years to go, because a lot of companies still do this whole root cause analysis, or they look for, and they don't like, they're more write, fix, and file. And I think we probably have, from that perspective, you know, it's going to be a continual long journey. We're at the beginning of it. Kind of think of like when continuous integration, continuous deployment came along, even the word DevOps, I know that's kind of, you know, looking at that and where it's been. We're probably another 10 years or more, I would say, you know, trying to get it there. And I think everybody has to continue to, essentially, unfortunately, in the preach mode a little bit and get into these organizations that you're in and try to implement and do little things to kind of make that change happen, whether it's from terminology to, you know, you're going underground to do incident analysis, but then all of a sudden it shows some great value and leaders like, oh, I want to do this all the time. So we're very much at the very beginning. I know, you know, companies are kind of trending towards doing using tooling for incident analysis and things like that. But I think we have a long journey to go, but it's an optimistic journey, I would say, at that from that side. And I'm looking forward to how it evolves and continues to evolve. And I think there are a lot of folks yearning for this type of different views of way we do incident retrospectives, and they want something different to get a better understanding of how humans perform with it also within the technical issues that we have with our systems. So I'm looking forward to it. Very optimistic about it. Yeah. I think it's going to be a great thing in the future.
I think so too. And I think you nailed it with the CI/CD DevOps lifecycle. The moment something starts to have commercialization and some legs, you know, it's usually an indicator. Like, you should pay attention to this, right?
And exactly.
We saw it with source control. We saw it with CI/CD. We saw it with feature flags, observability.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
We're right there.
Exactly.
So, agreed. With that, Chad, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Really, really amazing insights. I really enjoyed the conversation. And, you know, I can't wait to see what this conversation will sound like in 10 years when we see this all play out.
Yes.
But thanks so much.
Thank you for having me today. I love chatting with you, Robert. I appreciate it. And thanks for having me on.
The Better Incidents podcast is lovingly nurtured by the team at FireHydrant and made possible with generous contributions from the Better Incidents Collective. Learn more at betterincidents.com.